thank you. Well, good morning. Welcome. I'm Shannon Kuhn. I'm one of the pastors here at St. Andrews. If I haven't met you, I'd love to meet you at some point. We are continuing our sermon series called Summer Playlist, and we have compiled some of the greatest hits of our songbook, the Psalms, and we're taking them by topic each week. And now I grew up, before playlists, I grew up in the era of mixed tapes. So I remember many of my favorite mixtapes. We'd make them for gifts for people, for parties, for road trips. Somebody made a mixtape for me before I went to study abroad in Germany. And to this day, and that was a few decades ago, to this day, some of those songs, like Tribe Called Quest, some hip-hop songs, make me think about Germany. It has nothing to do with Germany, but I listened to those songs all that time. And so in my mind, when I hear it, it takes me back. And that's the effect that music has on us. It so deeply affects our souls. And brain researchers have studied this, that music triggers for us intense recollections from the past, and it provokes strong emotions from those previous experiences. Music has a chemical effect on our brains. It takes us back in time, but it also acts like a jolt of energy to fire the brain up and get it going. Recently, a few weekends ago, I was at my dad's house outside of Phoenix, melting in 112 degrees, but that's beside the point. He's downsizing and wanted to go through some of the things in his house, and so I was very eager to go through the record collection, because these are the records I grew up listening to, and I found this beauty. This is Elton John, Greatest Hits. I said, "Dad, remember this?" Well, he doesn't have the same memory attached to it that I do. So every time I hear this, what's that? Benny and the Jets, right? Every time I hear Benny and the Jets, it takes me back in time to Waukesha, Wisconsin, when on a Saturday morning, my parents would put on Elton John and we'd clean the house to Benny and the Jets. So when I hear it, it makes me think of those days, right? And we have collective memories as a culture around music. So when we hear this, who do we think of? Now, whether you were alive then or not, it's the king of rock and roll. It's Elvis Presley. You can picture him. You see the hair. This is before he got weird. He was very cool. He was the king of rock and roll. That's the era of this new type of music, rock and roll. And then the 70s, we heard this. Come on. The greatest guitar riff ever. If you've learned to play guitar, this is like what you begin learning. You just learn it, right? 70s rock. And then there's another thing that occurred in the 70s, and it's attached to this. Now you're going to get an image in your mind when you hear this. Come on, yep, let's see it, right? We know John Travolta in that white suit, right? We get this. It's a cultural memory that we have associated with this music. Now, if you're a person of the 80s, I know this is before a lot of you were born, but if you're from the 80s, this will conjure up an image for you as well. MTV. This was the song that was born with MTV, and you can't associate anything but that MTV logo with the song. So our cultural memory is very strongly attached to music as well. It takes us back in time and evokes those emotions. It's so powerful. And so for our summer playlist, today's psalm or song, this is the ancient song book of the church. It has a deep effect on many of us, and maybe you are one of them. It has been at the top of the biblical charts for centuries. It has outnumbered the Beatles and Taylor Swift combined hundreds of times over. It's Psalm 23. It's one of the greatest hits of all time. Do you know what makes a hit song a hit song? Generally, it's because hit songs have lyrics that resonate with listeners, and kind of on a personal level, and they capture these universal emotions and experiences. And so Psalm 23 is a hit song. probably number one on the list more than any others. So we're going to read it before we look at it more closely. And I'm not going to read it to you because I know I'm going to look out and you're going to be mouthing it anyway. So why don't we rise and read it together, shall we? The Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. He guides me along the right paths for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely your goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Please be seated. So, why is this such a beloved psalm? Maybe for you, this is one of your favorites. What does this psalm evoke in us when we hear the words? The words are comforting, right? They're reassuring, they're peaceful, they're grounding, they're loving, caring. This is one psalm of quite a few that we call trust psalms. And so there's a few. You can make note of them. You can read them over the course of the week. They're beautiful. And we need these trust psalms because we as humans, if we're honest, we have trust issues, don't we? We have trust issues. Look at Adam and Eve. They didn't trust that God's goodness and provision was enough. They wanted to try to get something for themselves and be godlike and take matters into their own hands. They didn't trust that what God had given them, which, by the way, was this gorgeous array of beautiful trees and fruit from these trees. There was just one that they couldn't have, but they didn't trust that God had provided all they needed. And so they took matters into their own hands. We have deep trust issues as humans that go all the way back to Adam and Eve. Now, social scientists have studied this topic of trust, and you might know one of these social scientists, Brené Brown. She's done a lot of writing about trust. And they've come up with kind of a really good, solid list of conditions that should be in place for us to really trust someone. We would know that the person is reliable and predictable, meaning they say they're going to do what they actually do what they say they're going to do. It's someone who's concerned with our needs. It's someone who can be relied upon to help us, and that we feel confidence in the strength of our relationship with the person. So if you can think of somebody in your life who you trust, hopefully it's your spouse, but you know, who is somebody that you really trust? Good friend, a parent, somebody. Are those conditions in place? Likely one, if not all, are in place, and these are really real for us to truly trust someone. So I did a little experiment this week, and knowing that I was going to be talking about trust and trust in God, I asked a few people this question and would like you to contemplate this question as well. What keeps us from fully, unequivocally trusting God? What is it that gets in the way of just 100% unconditional trust of God? Now, we go through phases of life. There are times where, we totally trust God, but then there are times where, I don't know. So what are these things? Well, here are some of the answers I got. Maybe you can relate to some of these answers. Somebody said fear of the unknown, right? I can't see how things are going to work out. Isn't that frustrating? Yeah, that's hard to trust sometimes. Somebody said, trust is not my natural state. It's not my default. Somebody else said, it's hard to trust God when I witness people going through unending suffering. And somebody said, or it's hard to trust when I see really good people who have bad things happen to them. Somebody else said, frankly, it's hard to trust God when things don't go the way I want them to go. Someone else said, it's not that I believe God can't, it's that I think he won't. Someone else said, I fall prey to that individualism that's in our world, right? The self-sufficiency, I can do this myself. And then another person was very honest and said, I think the root of it is selfishness, that I live for what I want. Those are honest obstacles to truly trusting God. And maybe you have your own reasons to add. But today, as we look at Psalm 23, I think we will see that those concerns are really addressed in this psalm. And I think that we will find that those conditions for trust, and there's a little reminder of what they are, that they are in place. The psalmist wants to show us these are things that are in place for us to truly trust God. So in the way that our minds will go back to John Travolta when we hear staying alive, hopefully the words of this psalm will help us remember that God is completely trustworthy. There's something about this psalm that really helps us with this, and it's that metaphor of a shepherd. You know, there's something that really evokes for us. It's comforting, it's wonderful, but I have to be honest, I'm a city girl, so what the heck is a shepherd? What is a shepherd? I don't know what a shepherd is. I've never met one. Maybe some of you have been one. There was somebody in the congregation last night who had been a shepherd. So what is a shepherd? A shepherd is somebody who owns, provides for, and manages and protects a flock of sheep, right? And the sheep are utterly dependent on that shepherd for everything, for everything. So in this metaphor, if God is the shepherd, then what are we? Sheep. You feeling sheepish today? We're sheepies. I don't really know what sheep are like either. And it's so funny because this man that was in the congregation last night said, he goes, they're dumb. I actually heard they're not necessarily dumb, that they can be intelligent, but the things they do look very dumb. They're bad decision makers. They also will follow kind of what the people and what the sheep in front of them are doing. So here's a great experiment that a farmer did. He took a rope and tied it taut across the exit of the barn. And so he brought the herd of sheep out, and the first ones, like, they were kind of hopping over that rope. And then he cut the rope so it was no longer an obstacle, and the back ones kept jumping too because they were just following what the ones in the front were doing. Yeah, that looks pretty dumb, doesn't it? Maybe there's something to that. They have no sense of direction. They have to be led. They are emotional animals. Very interesting. They form bonds with other sheep. And here's what I think is awesome. They recognize the voice of their shepherd. They know their shepherd's voice when they hear it. And the other thing about them is they're completely defenseless. They have no horns. They don't have quills. They don't have a venomous bite. They're defenseless. They have to be protected. So you can understand why this metaphor works for us as well as the sheep. There are some parallels there. So the psalm starts with, the Lord is my shepherd. The word Lord, it's Yahweh. The psalmist uses this word Yahweh. It's the most holy name of God. It's so holy that many Jews don't even pronounce that name. It's the name that God gave himself, I am. It's that verb of being. It infers that he's fully self-sufficient and eternal, no beginning, no end. The psalmist brilliantly takes this holy and enigmatic name of God and makes it so personal. He's a shepherd. No, he's my shepherd. This is a metaphor that would have been so personal to David, who we think wrote this psalm, because long before he was King David, he was shepherd boy David. So this metaphor would have been very important to him. And so in the same breath that the psalmist claims that Yahweh God is shepherd, he then says, semicolon, therefore I lack nothing. Some translations say, I shall not want. It's really about lack, because we're going to want things in this life. Come on. We want things. That's not going to stop. But in God, he will provide what we need. And so then the psalmist goes on, and we're going to look at three sections of the psalm because they tell us so much. So we're going to look at the first section of the psalm. He goes on, and he wants us to see why we won't lack. It's because God makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. He guides me along right paths. Notice all those verbs? We underline them. Verbs, verbs, verbs. God is active, initiating, constantly at work in our lives. He is working on your behalf, on my behalf, every single moment. He never tires. So let's go down that. What does that list of stuff mean to us? What are these things that he's doing? Well, in a barren landscape like the ancient Near East, and maybe some of you have been to Israel, you've seen that green pastures are hard to come by. You have to be very intentional and hardworking to even provide a green pasture. And so the shepherd does this. And then, how do you get sheep to lie down? Especially in a green pasture, they want to eat it. So they get their fill. They feel safe, and then they can lie down. This is a vision of flourishing, flourishing land, flourishing animals. Our shepherd desires and works toward our flourishing, our abundant living. And then quiet and still waters, that's this pure water that provides essential hydration. You know, sheep will just drink out of a muddy puddle. But our shepherd wants us to be drinking the best. He wants us to be content in this life with what he provides us because we can tend to drink from muddy waters. We can tend to think that what we can provide ourselves is better. But the shepherd wants to give us what's even better than we would choose for ourselves. The shepherd wants to give us better than what we would choose for ourselves. And to that end, the shepherd also wants his sheep to be refreshed, or restored is sometimes the word used there. It's actually this Hebrew word, shuf, which means to turn. He wants us to turn, to return to him. It's the soul. He wants our soul to return to him. Think about sometimes we get off the path a little. Get off path a little bit, but the shepherd wants us to return to him again and again. He desires that our very souls align with him. And then, as I mentioned earlier, sheep, they need guidance because they have no sense of direction. So the shepherd knows the best routes, the best paths, knows the terrain. And so sometimes we will take the wrong path, won't we? Sometimes we will let our self-will, our stubbornness, lead us down some ugly paths. But obeying our shepherd, staying on his paths, that helps us to live fully into this abundance that he wants for us. So you can see, these are just two verses. How much did this say to us about God? A lot, right? God is trustworthy because he's active. He's always initiating actions for our flourishing, for our provision, for our restoration, our guidance. You know, God is the owner who delights in his flock. God delights in you. And he wants no greater reward than to see that his sheep are content, that we're well-fed, that we're restored, we're flourishing under his care. He gives all that he has to us. We got all that just from those two verses. The second section of the psalm gives us a picture of a true act of trust in God. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me, your rod and your staff. They comfort me. So now the lush landscape, the green pasture, and the still water, those are behind us. Now we're going into a valley ahead. Now, a lot of translations will say the valley of the shadow of death. This is not about death. This word, this Hebrew word, is this dark, black. and it evokes this image of dread and gloom, this anxiety. It seems like it's death. This is not about the end of life. This is about those dark valleys we experience in the middle of life. The psalm says, though I walk, not if I walk, valleys are inevitable. And it says, I walk through the valley, not I end up there. Isn't that good? I walk through it. Valleys come and they go. Green pastures come and they go. Now, valleys are important because they're like this crucible of trust for us. These are the times when life does not go the way we planned. In fact, these are the times when painful and scary things happen to us. A spouse leaves us, an engagement is broken, a harrowing diagnosis is received, a tragic accident experienced. These are the days, sometimes months or years, when we feel the weight of the darkness outside of us and within us. And the fear of the unknown really comes in. It's much easier to trust God in the green pastures of life. But in the valley days, we can tend to wonder to ourselves, why would God let me end up on this path? Now, unfortunately, we are conditioned to think that if we are doing all the right things in life, God's goodness toward us will always look like earthly goodness. He'll heal us. He'll deliver us from disease. We'll have money in the bank, kids who turn out well, comfortable living. Unfortunately, that is a vision of life where good people have no problems. I don't know any good people who don't have problems. That's not a biblical vision of life. The valleys of life are the crucibles of our level of trust in God. Look at Job. Remember Job? Job was wealthy. He had a great family. I mean, he had sheep, he had flocks. He had lots of wealth. He had a pure heart. And tragedy came to him. It was all gone, except his wife. It was all gone. Family gone, all of his crop, everything was gone. And then to add injury to insult, he had these horrible sores on his body, right? So now he's in physical pain. And when he gets to the other side of this experience, he says this: my ears have heard of you, God, but now my eyes have seen you. The valley of his life brought him to an experience of God that he never would have had during those green pastures or still waters. And here's what's so important about this part of the psalm. There's a grammatical shift. No longer is the shepherd in the third person, he, but the second person, you are with me. Your rod and staff, they comfort me. He's no longer talking about God. He's talking to him. He's in relationship with him. He's trusting him. You see, when in danger, sheep, they don't look to other sheep for help. They look to the shepherd. They know him as the protector and caretaker. They focus on his rod and his staff, these instruments that protected them. They're focusing on him, not that dark, deathly abyss of the valley. Richard Foster once said this: God becomes a reality when he becomes a necessity. And Jerry Bridges, in his book on trusting God, says, you and I, we obviously don't seek out adversity just so that we can develop a greater trust in God. Rather, God, and this is important, God, through adversity, seeks us out. He draws us more and more into relationship with him. If we are seeking him, it is because he is seeking us. If, and this is good advice, if instead of fighting God or doubting him in times of adversity, if instead we will seek to cooperate with God, we will find that we will be drawn into a deeper relationship with him. It's hard to trust a God that we don't have a relationship with. It's hard. But when we do have a relationship with God and we do go through those valleys, good questions to ask during that time is, you know, what is God doing in me in this adversity, in this valley? Or what does God want to do with me in this adversity? Or what does God want to do for me? This is about relationship with God. The valleys are opportunities for us to grow in our relationship with God, and that's hard to hear. You know, I had a woman after the last service who just lost her only adult son to cancer. It is hard to trust God in those valleys. This is real. This is hard. But I think what's so beautiful about those valleys is that God is present with us every step of the way, because like sheep, we need that. We need his protection. We're defenseless. We need his presence every step of the way. And so the psalm shows us that God is trustworthy because he is always present with us, always reliable to help us. And the valleys, as hard as they are, there are opportunities for us to lean into our relationship with our shepherd and to focus on him, not the darkness around us. And the last section of the psalm says, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows." Notice the metaphor shifts here. We're no longer cute little sheepies, but now we're guests and God is a host. And we're not just at any table. The Hebrew word for this is like a banquet, like a royal banquet table. We're at a feast. He is hosting a feast for us. And this idea of anointing our head with oil, as odd as this may be, as foreign as it may be, what they would do is they would show how well they esteemed their guests, the host would, by breaking a beautiful bottle with this extravagant oil in it, and they would pour it on their head, and it would run down their robes with this fragrance. Psalm 45 calls it oil of joy. And then, this was kind of a social cue at the time. If you were a guest and your host was keeping your cup full, it meant you were still welcome. So if it started to run out, you know, your time, it was almost time to go. So what about a host that keeps it overflowing? How long can we stay with this host? Eternally, eternally. This section of the psalm shows us not just that God is always active working for us, not just that he is present with us in the valleys, but that he is lavish, lavish toward us. He wants so much for us, and he is generous, and he gives to us. And this is good because it's really hard to trust someone who's stingy, isn't it? Dallas Willard wrote in his book about Psalm 23, he said, "God is beyond rich. He's overflowing with everything that is good and everything we need. He has so much that he'll never run out of any of it. It is so very important to remember this when we are fretting over a perceived need. In such a time, we may be tempted to think that maybe, just maybe, God is as stingy and small as we are. God loves to give. Nothing so delights him as giving to anyone and everyone who will receive." And then at this point, Dallas Willard points to the ultimate lavish act of God. And he points to the scripture that says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son." So you see, David, if he was indeed the psalmist, he knew God as a shepherd, and he used this awesome metaphor to help us with our trust issues. But you and I, we know the good shepherd, capital G, embodied in Jesus Christ. Jesus personifies the shepherd of the psalm, the one who came, as he said, that we may have life and have it abundantly. He's the one who said he is living water, that if we come to him, we will no longer hunger or thirst. When he was with his disciples, he said he calls his sheep by name and we know his voice. That's because he is so personal to us. He's the visible expression of the invisible God, as Paul says. He's Emmanuel, God with us. He's present to us and with us, but he's also united to us in our suffering through his suffering. We go through no valley in this life that Jesus has not already traversed. He has gone before us. He is the epitome of the lavishness of love. He said himself, the good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. Jesus obeyed his Father by dying for us in our place on the cross. What a lavish love. We couldn't ask for any more. So the psalm ends with these words, "Surely goodness and love," some will say mercy, "shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever." Follow, by the way, is not the best translation. In Hebrew, it's pursue, it's chase. We just sang a song about how God chases after us. God pursues us and chases us with goodness. And instead of mercy, I like the word love because it's chesed, loving kindness, the steadfast love of God. He's chasing us with goodness and unconditional love. Because we were not made for just this world. We were made to dwell in the house of Yahweh. Notice it goes back to Yahweh forever. You know, this psalm, I've done, well over 100 memorials, and I think maybe one or two did not have Psalm 23 in them. This is chosen in memorial services. You may have already chosen it for yours if you've pre-planned yours. But this is why. Because we not only have a shepherd and a host on this side of eternity, but one on the other side of eternity who's going to welcome us when we're there. So fellow sheep, it's no secret that we have some trust issues. But we learn in this psalm that our shepherd is constantly at work, constantly working for our flourishing in this life. In fact, he's lavish toward us. He withholds no good. And when we go through those valleys, he wants us to rely on him, to seek him, because we can never do it alone. We won't do it alone. He is present to us, wanting a wonderful relationship with us. So may this psalm ignite in your memory these truths about the trustworthiness of our God and our Good Shepherd. May it be so. And now our worship team is going to come up and lead us in a time where we can just sort of reflect on these words. They're going to sing for us this beautiful song, a time of just reflection of how trustworthy our God and our Shepherd is.